Hi and welcome to the Homeopathy Health Show. I'm Atiq Ahmadbhatti, a fourth generation homeopath with over 25 years of professional experience and practice in this field of healing. The Homeopathy Health Show is the online voice of homeopathy around the world, promoting and raising awareness of this truly unique system of healing, which is suitable for all ages, young and old. Every week, I invite guests from the world of homeopathy to come and share their experiences, their work, offer insights, and essentially talk all things homeopathy. Why not visit www.liketreatslike.co.uk and click on the radio and podcast button to listen to the latest episodes. So let's begin today's show here on UK Health Radio, the world's number one talk health radio. I'm delighted to welcome my guest today on the Homeopathy Health Show podcast, and that is Dr. Vijay Vaishnav, who is an MD in homeopathy and is currently based in California in the US. Vijay, it's an absolute pleasure to have you on the podcast. Thank you so much, and how are you?
Thank you very much for inviting me, and I'm doing very well.
Great. That's good to know. And I know you're very, very busy as well, like us all, I suppose. It's strange, isn't it? Life seems to be passing by so quick.
Eh? Oh, yes.
I must say that your biography that you so kindly shared is very, very impressive. And there's so much to talk to you about. I mean, you have 38 years of practice, and that in itself is so commendable. But I wanted to start with asking you what led you to homeopathy. What was your journey and your take on homeopathy?
So actually, I came into homeopathy by accident. This was not really something that I had planned to do. Like most other kids in India, during my time as a student, you either wanted to be a doctor or an engineer. My grandfather was the physician to the royal family in Gujarat, and he was an eye specialist. So my dad also wanted to be a doctor, but due to some financial constraints, he had to drop out, and he had to take care of his mother because my grandfather died when he was 7 years old. So that always was something that my dad wanted to be, and I had heard a lot about my grandfather and how he used to treat patients, and how, in fact, there's a very funny story about how he was the first person to buy a car in that small kingdom. He was a doctor in a town called Bhuj in Kutch in Gujarat. And when he bought the car, the king summoned him and told him, "You cannot have a car. You have to sell it because I don't have a car. And if you have a car, it's below my dignity to be in the king of this small principality." So he was a very successful doctor. And I think that possibly was the reason why I wanted to be a doctor. Unfortunately, I just missed getting into the regular conventional medicine college, what is known as the MBBS course in India, by one mark. And I had been taking homeopathy as a patient from a local doctor. My grandmother had had some major health issues, and she was brought back from the door of death with homeopathic medicines. But that's all I knew about homeopathy. And when I was looking around, deciding what to do next and how I could become a doctor, someone suggested that there's a college in the neighboring suburb where I was living, and I could go and apply there. And I was on the top in the merit list there, so I just got in. And that's how I started my journey into homeopathy. So it was actually by accident. It was not really something that I planned to do. But then once I got in, I really enjoyed what I was doing. And I realized that every patient that comes to you is a challenge. And every patient is different, not like in conventional medicine where you just give the same set of painkillers or antibiotics or anti-inflammatories. So this was a big challenge, and it was interesting because you see all sorts of different types of patients, chronic as well as acute. And my interest kept growing to the point that after I graduated, I was asked to join the college as a teacher. And I continued being a teacher for almost 25 years then. So that, in short, is how I got into homeopathy.
That's a very interesting story indeed. And, you know, I was actually going, as you were saying that, I was just thinking that, you know, there's a time and place for everything. And every homeopath that I've spoken to, and I've spoken to thousands now, you know, for the podcast or off the podcast or just as friends or colleagues, they all have this beautiful story that, you know, almost is like they were at the right place at the right time or the wrong place at the right time, you know? And it's really fascinating. And again, your story is very, very inspiring indeed. And I was just thinking as you were saying that, and I shared this with somebody else recently, that in places like India and Pakistan, for example, where homeopathy is quite the norm, as in wherever you go, people know what homeopathy is. They talk homeopathy, they go to the store and they buy homeopathic medicines. And there's so much research being done. It's an absolutely phenomenal place to actually learn homeopathy because the sheer number of patients that you see as a doctor in India or other similar countries is just surpasses anything else in Western countries, doesn't it? I mean, there's 60 patients a day, can't you?
I agree with you because in my outpatient clinic in the hospital where I was teaching, in 2 hours, I used to see about 50 patients. And my wife, who was the head of the OBGYN department, she's a homeopath. She used to see around 80 to 90 patients in those 2 hours in the outpatient clinic there. While in the US, when we first came in here and when we talked about this to the other homeopaths, they said we would be burnt out if we just saw more than maybe 10 patients a day. So that's the difference. I mean, you end up seeing so many patients that your experience just goes beyond imagination. You learn a lot from your patients.
From this journey, you actually were very fortunate and blessed to be a professor and head of the Materia Medica at CMP Homeopathic College. And this is the college which is based in Mumbai in India. So can you tell us a bit more about, you know, what was involved there and how many students were there, the practices that were taking place at that time?
So the annual intake of students in this college is 100. And at any given time, there are at least around 400 students in the different classes. We have the first year, the second year, the third, and the fourth year. So on an average, there are at least 400 to 450 students who are attending college. And in my lifetime there, I must have trained over 2,500 students, or more maybe, as a full-time teacher. And the curriculum is exactly similar to what a regular doctor would go through. So you have anatomy and physiology and the preclinical subjects. Then you have pathology, forensic medicine, and then the subjects of medicine, internal medicine, gynecology, surgery. And on top of that, you're also taught the homeopathic subjects of homeopathic pharmacy, the philosophy, materia medica, repertory. So it's a very intensive course, and it's spread over 4.5 years. And at the end of 4.5 years, you have to also do a compulsory 1 year internship in the hospital. So you actually get hands-on training from the second year onwards as a student, because you start attending the wards in the outpatient clinic. But in the final year after you graduated, you are still supposed to do 1 year's internship, where you actually hone in on your skills and you learn to handle patients on your own. So it is a very grueling time if you really take your life seriously there. And when you come out from this college, you usually would be a very skilled homeopath, because you've seen some really good practitioners practicing and teaching you. And you also have sometimes others, well-known homeopaths, coming in and teaching at seminars or workshops. So you end up learning quite a lot. And depending on what your interest is, then you finally decide how you want to practice. So I started as a demonstrator, and then gradually went in to be a lecturer. And then the hierarchy is you become an assistant professor and then finally a professor. So over those 25 years, I started as the junior most at the bottom of the rung, and gradually climbed up as my experience in homeopathy, teaching as well as seeing patients increased. So it was a great journey, because when I was a student, we had some very good teachers and some not so good teachers. And I had decided that if ever I become a teacher, I want to make sure that none of my students miss out on good homeopathy and they get abundance of knowledge. So I used to go out of my way to teach. And I think that helped, because students realized that they can always count on me to give them a lot of information and help, not just with academics, but life in general. So it was good knowing so many students who still remember me after so many years.
Do you miss those days?
Not completely. teaching is my passion. So I used to love to teach. And even at the end of maybe 20 years or 25 years of teaching, before every lecture, I used to open up at least 25 to 30 reference books to prepare for my lecture. Even if I've taught it the previous term, I would still like to sit down and go through all the possible literature, because I want to make sure that nothing is missed out. And I've always found that because of your experience in treating patients, the next time you open up any of your books of Materia Medica and you open a drug and you start reading it, you find a symptom that you never read before or you never knew before. And that's because you just treated someone maybe a year ago or 6 months ago or a week ago, and that symptom now matches. So every time you open the Materia Medica, even though you might claim to be the expert, you'll always find something new which you had missed. So it's a journey. And as it is said, teaching is the best form of learning. So it's a good learning for any teacher. Whenever you start teaching, you keep endlessly learning something from what you're giving to your students.
You know, there's something very profound with what you were saying, which is to do with symptoms. And sometimes you read something new in a Materia Medica, which perhaps one hadn't paid attention to.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, going back to the writers or the compilers of these Materia Medica, let's talk Hahnemann and Clark and Kent and Allen and Boyrecki and so forth, and so many more, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm just astounded that how much detail, and you're not talking 20th century, you know, 21st century rather, you know, you're talking 20th century, and the amount of detail. And I mean, it's mind-boggling, isn't it, that somebody would sit and dedicate and give the minutest symptom to jot down or write down the minutest symptom, which was, you know, repeatedly observed or witnessed. And it's just incredible, isn't it, how much work has actually gone into these Materia Medica. That we open the book and we think, whichever one we're using, and it's like, okay, this is the remedy and these are the mm-hmm. keynotes, and, you know, mind, body, abdomen, whatever it is, and generalities. And but somebody actually had to go through that line by line by line, perhaps not in the format we're used to, of course, But, you know, certainly they jotted everything down. And what a skill. I mean, wow, you know?
And they didn't have computers to help them.
Mm,
so it, all indexing and everything was done manually. And that's a lot of effort and a lot of dedication.
It's incredible, isn't it? Really is something.
It is. I think they were the real pioneers of homeopathy. And what we get now is just old wine in new bottles. So everything that you want to know about homeopathy that people talk about now is actually already been talked about. It's just that it's been rebranded and given to you in a different way.
That's an interesting take on it, actually.
The station that makes you feel good.
Nature's Medicine for Modern Living, a people and plants dialogue hosted by Sophie.Health. At Sophie, we bring together experts and voices who rarely cross paths. Our quest is to illuminate the ancient world of plant medicine and reimagine it for the connected age. Join us to explore new boundaries of digital personalized medicine with deep roots in the natural world and hear from our community of international pioneers who are validating this new paradigm and improving how we feel, sleep, and cope with daily stresses naturally. Sophie.Health, reconnecting people and plants.
Once upon a time, human slavery was just a fact of life. Right now, animal abuse is often considered normal. In time, it won't be. Animal Aid campaigns peacefully against all forms of animal abuse and promotes cruelty-free living.
Check out animalaid.org.uk. It's time for a kinder world.
The station that makes you feel good.
Which now leads me on to from the actual college. You are involved, or were involved, should I say, because you're now based in California, but you were involved in looking at new concepts for Materia Medica. And from there, something I'm very interested to actually ask you is this new model of approach that you've come up with, which is very unique to the study of homeopathic therapeutics. Do share your wisdom with us, you know, what these approaches are and the concepts as far as Materia Medica study.
So basically, I'm sure all those who have been to a homeopathy school have been told that homeopathy is a science as well as an art. And it's always been very difficult for us to prove the scientific part of homeopathy. So I had the advantage of also being assigned to attend the wards and the outpatient department of one of the largest allopathic hospitals in Mumbai, the KEM hospital, which is a teaching hospital. So I was with the head of the department for almost 2 years in that department, and I was attending everything. I used to attend the emergencies at night. I used to assist in a lot of procedures. The aim was to train me to finally be able to teach homeopathic medicine in an integrated way, where you teach the students not just homeopathic therapeutics, but also how to use the knowledge of internal medicine and clinical medicine in their practice. And that has been the basic idea which I like to put forward to my students when I teach them, whether it's Materia Medica or whether it is therapeutics. Because we, for example, if you read Boger's Synoptic Key, he talks about locations and he talks about modalities, and then you have the small description of the remedy. So locations basically is sphere of action. And every drug has a sphere of action. What you need to study in a Materia Medica is the sphere of action and the pathogenesis, Now, pathogenesis is what does that remedy do to that one particular part? How does it bring about changes there? And as a result of those changes, what symptoms develop? So it makes it easy for you to understand the materia medica instead of memorizing it. So for example, let's take a rare remedy like millefolium. I'm just taking one out of the, just as an example. So the symptoms of millefolium are, you get hemorrhages, which are bright red. And from the slightest injury, they tap their hand against something and there might be a spot of bleeding under the skin. Or someone touches the nose and they start bleeding. But it's a passive hemorrhage. It's bright red. And from the slightest injury or slightest misstep. Now, if you look at the sphere of action of millefolium, that we have homeopathic remedies that either, like aconite, works on arteries. Its sphere of action is it causes congestion and inflammation of arteries. We have drugs that act on veins like pulsatilla or carbovich. While in the case of millefolium, it's neither the artery nor the vein, it is the capillary. And what does it do? So the sphere of action is capillaries. What does it do to the capillaries? It makes them very fragile. They break easily. And so that's the reason why the slightest injury, misstep causes them to bleed. Now, because it's a capillary bleeding, it's never going to be gushing like belladonna, nor is it going to be dark like carbovich or lachesis. It is bright red, but it is easy gush. And because it's something that he might not even notice because he's walking about, you don't even have the anxiety that you get with hemorrhages like in case of aconite. So this is the way I also help them understand how to differentiate remedies. So while I was talking about millefolium, I talked about aconite, I talked about belladonna, carbovich, and of course, in a classroom setting, it is much more detailed. Then we would go into the different features of each of those remedies and how they produce the hemorrhage. So even a small remedy like millefolium, you can understand the sphere of action, the pathogenesis, and the guiding symptoms. You can take mercury, Merck salt, or you can take pulsatilla, for example, which is a very common remedy. Everyone knows about it. So sometimes it's possible for, and why pulsatilla? Because it's a venous remedy compared to millefolium, which is a remedy that acts on capillaries. So the important guiding symptoms of pulsatilla are worse in the evening, worse in a warm room, better in the open air, better by slow, gentle motion. How do we translate this and how do we understand this? Because it is easy to memorize for some people. Some people cannot memorize it and then they end up making mistakes when in the examination and actually when they're seeing a patient. So the sphere of action of this remedy is the right side of the heart and the veins, not the capillaries. So the veins actually continue into the right atrium and then the right ventricle. So the right side of the heart is what is usually affected in pulsatilla. Pulsatilla also has anemia. So there's a lot of chlorosis and anemia as a part of this remedy. And you find that because of the fact that they have anemia, and anemia means they have a poor oxygen carrying capacity, the blood is usually shunted to the vital organs. And you find that as long as they are perfectly warm and covered, they feel good. As long as they are outside in the open air, they feel good. As soon as they come into the room, when they are overheated, the symptoms get worse because all the shunting of the blood from the vital organs comes back to the skin and the person starts feeling a discomfort because the vital organs don't have the blood. The same with the fact that because the heart is not pumping as well and the veins are weak, the calf muscles are what helps to pump the blood and help with the circulation of blood in the veins. So if the person walks about, there's a good pumping action and that helps to bring about a proper circulation of blood. And the patient starts feeling better when she walks. And that too, when she walks gently. If she walks or she exercises, there's a weakness of the heart and she will feel out of breath. So it's possible for you to understand the remedy, and that makes it easy to differentiate remedies too. Now, for example, CPR. CPR is a drug which is always better by exercising, better by dancing. They like to exercise, they like to dance because it seems to help them. Why? Why is what we ask? That's what I ask the students to ask me or ask any other teacher of material medical. Why is this symptom there? Why is it so peculiar? So in CPR, for example, there's a lot of congestion in the pelvic organs at the expense of blood being in the vital organs. So there's a lot of pelvic congestion. They have a fullness in the lower abdomen. They have a feeling as if the uterus is being pushed out because of this congestion. And when they start exercising, when they run or when they dance or when they do any sort of aerobic exercise, there's a redistribution of blood because blood is now required in the muscles, in the extremities. This redistribution reduces the congestion that she felt in the pelvic region. And it seems to go back to the lungs, to the heart and everywhere else. And she starts feeling better. So sphere of action, pathogenesis, and the guiding symptoms. That's how you study your homeopathic remedy. Now, the same thing applies in the study of therapeutics. Usually what happens is you pick up any book of therapeutics, for example, Dewey's therapeutics or Lilienthal's therapeutics. You have the name of the disease and the list of remedies from A to Z. And the symptoms are listed there. My approach is, how about trying to correlate the constitution, the pathology, and the miasm, and then study your therapeutics. For example, if you take the locomotor system, the patient comes with rheumatism, for example, or joint complaints. When will you prescribe a particular remedy? For me, I would look at it from mainly the constitutional point of view. See whether this person has the psoriatic miasm, which is prominent, the psychotic miasm is prominent, is it the tubercular miasm or is it the syphilitic miasm? I'm just talking about the fundamental miasms, not the new ones that have been added recently. But I'm looking at just what was contemporary at Honeyman's time and after Honeyman. So for example, a person comes with joint pains, and you think she's in the psoriatic phase, then I would think of either calcarea carb or lycopodium or sulfur. Now, if it's calcarea carb, the psoriatic manifestation could be just the obesity causing joint affections, or it could be some amount of calcium metabolism. If it's calcium metabolism, then maybe calcarea fos if there's osteoporosis, and calcarea floor if there is osteoarthritis or there are bony growths, or calcarea hypophosphorica if there is some abscess. Now, calcarea, lyco, sulfur also form a cyclical relationship. And when you study calcarea carb, you would look at also endocrinal problems, thyroid disease causing obesity. Calcarea carb is a good remedy for thyroid disease. So you try to correlate the pathology, the miasm, and the remedy, and try to understand the remedy from in toto, not just the symptoms. Don't just memorize the symptoms of the drug, but try to understand its practical application in your patient. If it's lycopodium, we all know that there's a 4 to 8 p.m. aggravation, there's a right-sidedness of the remedy, but that's just basic materia medica. Where is it useful? So if you look at the sphere of action and the pathogenesis, you're taught about the uric acid diathesis. That means this drug would also be useful for gout. Also for patients who have other places where there might be stone formation, like gallbladder stones, kidney stones. So if you have a patient with multiple metabolic problems with the uric acid diathesis, you would think of lycopodium as the remedy. And then you look at the acutes of lycopodium. Maybe the person in the acute state might need a drug like urticarurex, or they might need benzoic acid, or they might need Ruta, which are again of the same uric acid diathesis. So while you are studying the materia medica or the therapeutics, you don't just study the drug and from A to Z, but understand the remedy. What does it do there? What is the pathology? Which miasm is very prominent? If it's the psychotic miasm, I would think of Netram Self, Tuja, and Causticum as a central remedies. Teach those and then expand upon it. Between Tuja, Netram Self, and Causticum, you have one very important differentiation, that Causticum is better in damp wet, while the other two are worse in damp wet. So people who get joint pains, which are worse in the damp, rainy season, then Netram Self and Tuja might be thought of. But if they're better in the damp wet, I would think of Causticum. However, Causticum goes one step further, and there are ankylosis of joints. So it would also be useful for rheumatoid arthritis, not just simple arthritis. And you try to then understand other remedies which could be useful with Causticum for rheumatoid arthritis. If it's the syphilitic miasm, where there's destruction, you would think of Kali iodatum. You could think of asafoetida, where there is destruction of the bones, destruction of the joints, and aurum metallicum, for example. So the thing is, instead of learning it from A to Z, try to understand and try to form an idea about what is the pathogenesis in the remedy. Does it fit with the pathology that you're looking at? And what is the miasm? Because if you give a drug based on the wrong miasm, it's not going to really be very useful. So everything should be right and everything should fit like pieces in a jigsaw puzzle. And that gives you the ideal response that you expect in your patients. This is something that people don't talk about, but it's always good to correlate medicine, surgery, gynecology, and pathology with homeopathy, because that makes it easy for you to look at each patient. It makes it easy for you to talk to somebody else from the conventional field of medicine. And also makes it easy for them to understand what you're doing and give them results and show them how the pathology has changed.
It's almost medical homeopathy, isn't it? You could call it medical homeopathy.
Yes. And homeopathy is one of the systems of medicine. It's not something that is out of some hocus pocus that is being done. So you need to see that it gets its rightful place in medicine.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
When you vacation with Norwegian Cruise Line, every day is a new day. Get a taste for Barcelona, then savor incredible dining options back on board one day. Connect to ancient history in Athens, and then disconnect completely in our spa another day. Wherever the sea breeze takes you, come aboard and experience a different tomorrow with NCL. Visit ncl.com, call your travel agent, or call 0333-336-1472. Norwegian Cruise Line, Ships Registry, the Bahamas and USA.
Apples and pears, beef and skittles, cider with Rosie, common or garden, Ant and Deck, fish and chips, mum and dad.
UK Health Radio and Health Triangle magazine. Each is good by itself, but enjoying both is always better. Add Health Triangle magazine to your monthly health regime. Check it out at ukhealthradio.com. Strawberries and
cream. A cancer diagnosis can be scary and stressful for everyone involved. Hello Love is a contemporary living space and well-being center in central London where anyone can come and learn about illness prevention and non-toxic practice. Inside, you will find a vegan restaurant, juice bar, and holistic dojo that encourage lifestyle changes to help heal mind, body, and spirit connection. Cancer patients are offered free sessions. To find out more, please visit us at hellolove.org.
the station that makes you feel good.
And we mustn't forget that even the founder of homeopathy himself was a medical doctor.
Oh, yes.
As were so many others after him, nearly all of them, one may say, you know. And, you know, that's something not to forget, that they had medical knowledge. So perhaps, you know, that was their way of being so detailed as far as the analysis for for materia medica is concerned, and the remedies and the signatures or the pictures of the remedies, because they had this medical aptitude and training behind them.
Right.
And they were perhaps, I know we moved on, of course, in leaps and bounds, medicine has, of course, which is amazing. But, you know, in those days, as it was medicine, but they were still looking at organs and body and blood flow. And certainly those things were there, you know, they were aware of those.
And even before the microscope, they were able to predict that there could be microorganisms that are associated with diseases. Not, they may not be the cause of disease like modern medicine believes, but at least they thought that there is some association between the microorganisms. Maybe they came in later as scavengers, but at least that was something that they could even perceive and think about in those days.
That's I hope that you are running some type of training classes. Is that something you're actually doing where you are at the moment?
I don't really have the time right now.
Yeah.
That is my aim, and I do teach at different conferences, and sometimes I get called to teach for some of the institutions in India. So that either if I'm there, it's in person, otherwise it's all through Zoom.
Ah, the blessings of Zoom, eh?
Oh, yeah.
brilliant. Now, you know, with this approach to the study of homeopathic therapeutics, which, you know, is amazing, you've just shared with us. Coupled with that, you have, of course, 38 years of clinical practice.
Mm-hmm.
So what changes have you seen as far as, well, I suppose as far as homeopathy and how it was and how it is, and the increase perhaps of use of homeopathy, what are your sort of insights into that? What's over 38 years is a very, very long time, and a very must have been an amazing time, and you must have seen so many changes take place.
Yes, so I think in India, where it was almost mainstream, especially in large cities like Mumbai, where there's a lot of awareness and a high literacy rate, people are more aware of homeopathy. So I don't think there's been a major change as such, because it always was well accepted. Though, of course, I think many of the local insurance companies there do reimburse for homeopathy, which is a great thing. And there have been lots of changes in the laws that have made it very clear. It was always a gray area earlier, and now it's very clear that homeopaths are at par with the doctors who have had their MBBS or the MD, and they have the same rights as those doctors as far as certifying health, certifying death, or giving other certificates for the issuance of passports and licenses, driving licenses, etc. But there's been a definite change in the attitude, thanks to even changes made by the government, and that is reflected all the way down. So there are lots of primary healthcare centers that have opened up where they actually look for homeopaths to join. That's a great change that you see, at least in India. In the US, I think over the last 12 years that I've been here, it is quickly catching up. We all know about the history of homeopathy in the early 1900s, where it was flourishing at one time, and then thanks to the Flexner report and the different pharmaceutical lobbies, it had to take a back seat, but it's coming back again. And we have lots of different well-known homeopaths. There are lots of new provings being done. There are some very good researchers in homeopathy in the US, and it's good to see that there's a resurgence.
What's your experience? I mean, you, like you said, you've been in the US now for 12 years. So how is it, are people at that stage where they, irrespective of whether they use homeopathy or not, but are they aware that there is this, you know, there is another system of medicine that's called homeopathy?
Yes. And this is more so on the western part of the US and maybe the East Coast, where, again, there's the population is more cosmopolitan. Population is more so-called international, where you have lots of people from other countries, mainly on the East and the West Coast. And they have been aware of homeopathy, and they seek homeopathy. So we are in California, which is on the West Coast. All the states here, right from Washington State and Oregon, California, and also to some extent Nevada, you have a lot of homeopathic practitioners. There are lots of homeopathy schools. There are naturopathy colleges which are accredited by the US government, which teaches homeopathy. And you can actually major in homeopathy in the last 2 years. And though you're a naturopath, you can still come out as a homeopathic specialist, and you can graduate as one. So there have been lots of changes. When I first came in here in the year 1992 as a tourist, there were a handful of homeopaths in California, and not much was going on. But then in California, for example, the Senate passed a bill which allowed a patient to choose what sort of treatment he wants. And it also allowed alternative therapy practitioners to be able to set up practice as long as they conform to certain codes and ethics and guidelines that were set up. But it has made it easier for homeopaths, Ayurvedic doctors, acupuncturists to practice and give the best to their clients in California. And I think most of the other states on the West Coast have their own corresponding such bills that help them practice.
That's very inspiring to know, and also the fact that people do have a choice, and that's actually, I mean, that's the best part of all of this, that it's you're able to flourish, just like we've mentioned with great detail about how homeopathy is seen in India, or should I rephrase, you know, it's medicine, and then there's Ayurvedic medicine, and there's other medicines, and homeopathy, and everything is almost in parallel. So the respect is there, the use is there, the awareness is there. And that's a good thing. And if that continues in the US, I think, further afield, it's only a good thing. It's good to be aware.
And we actually have, it's surprising, but we have the regular practitioners referring their patients to us. So we have, there's a psychiatrist who has been sending all her patients to us because she wants to help us taper off those medicines. So when we start the constitutional remedy for those psychiatric cases, whether that's depression or anxiety or schizophrenia, over a period of time, she then starts tapering off the conventional psychiatric remedy, the drugs, to a point where they are on very low dose of those medicines and they remain on homeopathy. So there are some other physicians, skin doctors who have been sending their patients to us. It's just, I think, some patient improves and talks to them about it, and then they are open to it. That's the best part of it. They're open to homeopathy. They're willing to give a try, which was not so about maybe 15 years ago.
Yeah, that's really, really good to know, actually. I'm really happy about that, actually. I'm sure everyone listening to this podcast is going to have the same feeling as me.
And I think the other thing that homeopathy does is it makes the patient or the client feel that someone is listening to them. Most of the time when they go to a physician, they don't have enough time for that because they need to do a lot of paperwork anyway after that. So they give you about 10 or 15 minutes. You got to finish off whatever you have to say, maybe even less time than that. They might do a quick examination and then they send you away. While a homeopath sits with you, talks to you for maybe an hour or so, initially at least, and then every follow-up is at least 30 minutes where they ask a lot of questions. And he turns into more of a friend, philosopher, and guide for you. And it helps them also unburden themselves. So a lot of the physical symptoms are as a result of a lot of emotional baggages that they're carrying. And if they're able to release some of that and get rid of that because of the process of homeopathic treatment, it's not just the medicines, but the fact that the physician talks to them or the doctor is giving them time, making them look at themselves from a different point of view, it makes a lot of difference. It is much more fulfilling, both to the patient as well as for the practitioner.
And that's absolutely true. And it is about listening, and the fact that sometimes you just, you know, when they say, don't they, that a great weight has been lifted off my shoulders. You know, when you share your trials and tribulations and health concerns and anxieties and worries, and of course, that doesn't mean you share them with everybody, of course not. But as far as a practitioner is concerned, as a homeopath specifically, there's a lot of counseling involved. And it's only a good thing, because sometimes 50%, like you've quite rightly said, the condition is gone because someone has lifted that burden and almost shed it off themselves. And that energy, that negative energy is diffused. And that's so, so important, because people are not inclined to talk about health sometimes. And some subjects they feel are very taboo, and to be able to share is such a big part of homeopathy, because the practitioner has to know to be able to pinpoint the remedy or remedy, you know? And so in fact, just by the process of homeopathy itself, which is another blessing of homeopathy, you can actually relieve someone's, the burden that someone's carrying just by the process of going to see a homeopath, because of the certain questions they're going to ask. So it's a win-win situation.
Right.
It's been an absolute pleasure. You'll be surprised to know that we're actually out of time. That really was very inspiring, and it's been an absolute delight to have you. I have to say this again, but Dr. Vijay Vaishnav, a real joy and honor to have you on the podcast, and I do hope you'll come back and we can talk maybe in more depth on some of the strategies and your methodologies and the protocols that you follow.
Sure. Yeah, I think there's a lot to talk about. So we can talk about acute prescriptions, chronic prescriptions, some of the conditions where we had miraculous changes seen in the patients, and some conditions where the patients were maybe on their deathbed, and how we helped ease them and made them live for a longer time. So there's a lot. Homeopathy has done a lot to our patients, and it's always good to share so that people can get inspired and maybe also think of practicing much more seriously and without really being affected by what they hear from others about homeopathy.
Absolutely. Well, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you very much once again for giving me this opportunity to speak with you.
And that was the charming Dr. Vijay Vaishnav from California in the US, originally from India, a very qualified homeopathic doctor. So I do hope you've enjoyed this week's episode of the Homeopathy Health Show. As always, it's a great honor to be able to host this. And I pray that it continues long into the future as such. I've got a busy week coming up. I have a number of books. I've got a number of books to read, but I can't actually read them in a week. But I'll tell you what they are, actually. There's two books by Rudolf Steiner. The first one is The Essential Steiner, and then there's one which is titled Knowledge of the Higher Worlds. And then I've got two books which my friend Colin Griffith has, he's asked me to make sure I read them. And the first one is a book by Robert Temple, and it's called A New Science of Heaven. And then we have another one, which is not homeopathic, but it's by a gentleman called Jarrad Diamond. And that is the book called Collapse. And then I'm also going through an amazing book by Jeremy Scher, which is The Noble Adventures of Beryl and Carol. If you go to my Instagram, like_treatslike, you'll actually see a few trailers as such on Beryl and Carol, the book itself, but also a special recording of a poem within the book, which Jeremy so kindly recorded for me so that I could use it on the socials. So, hey, those are some of the books, and there are actually a bit more. There's a few more that have come in, but I can only read so much. But what I'm really excited about, actually, is Colin Griffith's new book, which is the Materia Medica, and that's the third actual volume. And I'm really, really looking forward to that. So that's called The New Materia Medica, Volume 3. And I shall be taking time to read that. And the reason for that is because Colin is coming back on the show. Yee! I can't wait for that because there's so much to talk about the new book. But until next week's episode, as always, stay safe and take care. I do hope you've enjoyed this week's episode of the Homeopathy Health Show. Please do support the show by clicking follow on my socials. Remember, the more exposure the podcast receives, the better for homeopathy around the world. You can find me on Instagram by searching for @like_treatslike, and on both Facebook and TikTok by searching for @like_treatslike. So let's promote the voice of homeopathy on radio and podcast around the world together. Don't forget to visit me online at www.liketreatslike.co.uk and click on the radio and podcast tab. Here you'll be able to see all the guests that have joined me on the show so far. And of course, you can stream on demand the latest episode to your mobile, tablet, or PC. Until next time, stay safe and take care.